between 1964 and 1965, the bodies of six young women were found in or near the River Thames in London. Local people and news reporters dubbed the killer Jack the Stripper because of the similarities to the original Jack the Ripper case from 1888, in that all the victims were prostitutes. However, the difference in the Jack the Stripper case is that he left his victims naked. It's suggested that there were two earlier murders between 1959 and 1963, which may have been committed by the same perpetrator. But, like the mysterious Jack the Ripper of old, this elusive killer was never caught. However, that hasn't stopped people from speculating who the killer could be. Suspects ranged from a security guard to a boxing champion. Hey everybody, this is the Students' Verdict Podcast. Welcome to episode 9, Jack the Stripper, Not a Typo. Thank you so much for joining me. For those of you who are new, hi, my name is Emily and I'm your host. If you haven't already, please go and listen to some of our earlier episodes, which include cases such as the disappearance of Marlene Oakes. We've got an episode dedicated to vigilantes and an episode dedicated to the McMartin preschool abuse scandal. Also, please follow us on Instagram at the Student Verdict Pod. That's recently changed, so it's P-O-D. And on Twitter at Student Verdict. Resources used in this episode will always be linked in the show notes. If you enjoy the show, please rate and review. If you don't enjoy it, then keep your opinions to yourself. Now, let's jump into today's episode. Our story today begins in the swinging 60s, a time of the Beatles, miniskirts, and sexual liberation. Britain had moved on from the Second World War. Conscription, which had been introduced in 1916, compelling all fit males of military age to join the war effort, had been abolished, so we had a generation of teenagers free from conscription. Following the war, feminism became more influential as more jobs became available to women, allowing them to move out of their parents' homes and become more independent. Colour television and pocket transistors were created in the 1960s, allowing people to spend their time listening to music and watching TV. With all of this, the 1960s also saw some of the most notorious gangsters, including the Cray twins, Ronnie and Reggie, who controlled organised crime in London's East End. Their associates, such as drug trafficker Jack the Hat McVitie, who would eventually die at the hands of Reggie Cray. There was the Richardson Gang, run by Charlie and Eddie in South London during the 1960s, who were known rivals of the Cray twins. If you haven't watched Legend already, then please do. It's such a good film where Tom Hardy plays both Ronnie and Reggie Cray. But anyway, that's a glimpse of London in the 1960s. At 5:10 a.m. on the 17th of June 1959, the body of a young woman was discovered by police on scrubland between Dan Mason Drive and a towpath next to the River Thames. This area had a reputation as a lover's lane, where prostitutes were known to take their clients. The police had been on routine patrol in Duke's Meadows, Chiswick, on the north bank of the river when they came across the young woman's body. A pathologist would later conclude that the woman died between midnight and 2 a.m. on the 17th of June, only a few hours before her body was discovered. The woman had been wearing a dress which was torn, exposing her breasts, and there were scratch marks on her neck. Her underwear, black stilettos, and handbag were missing, and despite searches of the surrounding areas and the riverbed, these items were never recovered. The pathologist found marks on the victim's neck consistent with strangulation. Post-mortem photos of the victim's face were circulated in the news, causing the mother and roommate of Elizabeth Figg to contact police. Elizabeth Figg had been born in Cheshire on the 24th of March 1938. She was a known prostitute in the local area. The proprietor of a pub on the opposite side of the River Thames from where Figg was found recalled that on the night of the murder, he and his wife had seen a car's headlights as it parked at 12:05 a.m. Shortly after the lights were switched off, there was a scream as a man and a woman struggled inside the beige estate car. Elizabeth Kafka said, quote, "It was pitiful to hear her shrieks, but no one went to help the girl. Notting Hill is a dangerous place to mind other people's business." Just 6 hours later, Elizabeth Figg's body was found. Police theorised that Elizabeth was murdered by a client in his car. He then drove off, leaving her body at Duke's Meadow, but with her handbag, shoes and underwear still in his vehicle. Our next victim was Gwyneth Rees. Sadly, there isn't too much information about her. Gwyneth was born on the 6th of August 1941 in Barry, Wales. She worked as a prostitute before she disappeared in 1963, when she was just 22 years old. Her body was discovered on the 8th of November 1963 at the Barnes Borough Council Household Refuse Disposal Site on Townmead Road, Mortlake. The dump where Gwyneth's body was found was about 40 yards from the Thames towpath and approximately 1 mile from Duke's Meadow, where Elizabeth's body had been found. When her body was discovered, Gwyneth was naked, except for a single stocking on her right leg, extending no further up than the ankle. Her cause of death was unknown. This may have been because she'd been accidentally decapitated by a shovel when workmen had been levelling the refuse. Although the murders of Elizabeth Figg and Gwyneth Rees have now been connected with the stripper case, his first confirmed victim was actually Hannah Tailford. Hannah Tailford was found dead on the 2nd of February 1963 on the Thames foreshore below the clubhouse of the London Corinthian Sailing Club, west of Hammersmith Bridge. She'd been born on the 19th of August 1933 in Northumberland, England, meaning she was 30 years old when she died. On the night she disappeared, that's the 24th of January, Hannah had left her young daughter with her partner at their flat in West Norwood, South London. Little did she know that would be the last time she would see her daughter and partner again. The pathologist concluded her cause of death as drowning in a bathtub, although there were signs of strangulation. Her body was then thrown into the River Thames, where the body of Elizabeth Figg had been found. In the case of Hannah Tailford, several of her teeth were missing. It's speculated that they were kept as a trophy, and her underwear had been stuffed into her mouth. The stripper's next victim was Irene Lockwood, whose body was discovered on the 8th of April 1964 on the foreshore of the Thames at Corney Reach, Chiswick, not far from where Hannah Tailford had been found. Irene Lockwood was born on the 29th of September 1938 in Nottinghamshire, England. She worked as a prostitute in London and was last seen the night before she died at the Windmill Pub on Chiswick High Road. The pathologist determined that she too died by drowning. He also confirmed that Lockwood was sadly pregnant at the time she died. With the number of victims increasing and the obvious similarities in the cases, the police knew that they had a serial killer. Helen Barthelemy was born on the 9th of June 1941 in East Lothian, Scotland, before she moved to London, where she worked as a prostitute. The last positive sighting of Barthelemy was at her bedsit in Willesden 3 days earlier. Helen Barthelemy's body was found on the 24th of April 1964 in an alleyway at the rear of 199 Boston Manor Road in Brentford. As we've seen with the other cases, the cause of death was asphyxiation by strangulation. This case was different though. This victim gave police a clue that they could work with. Flecks of paint were found on her body. The sort of paint car manufacturers would use. Police therefore believed that the paint likely came from the killer's place of work, and so they aimed to trace the source of the paint. The same paint spots were also found on the next victim, Mary Fleming. Fleming was born in Clydebank, Scotland on the 16th of September 1933. Coincidentally, this is also my birthday, so put it in your diaries. I expect to hear from all of you saying happy birthday. Fleming originally disappeared on the 11th of July 1964. She'd been soliciting on Queensway before her body was discovered 3 days later outside 48 Berrymead Road, Chiswick. Neighbours in the area told police that they had heard a car reversing down the street shortly before Fleming's body was discovered. Our penultimate victim is Frances Brown from Glasgow. She was last seen alive on the 23rd of October 1964. A colleague of Frances saw the young woman get into a client's car. Her body would be discovered 2 days later in a car park on Haunton Street in Kensington. Her colleague, Kim Taylor, was able to provide a description of the vehicle, which matched the description of a Ford Zephyr. She also provided police with an identikit picture of the client. The individual or individuals have never been traced. A particularly interesting thing about Frances Brown is that she had testified against Stephen Ward during his trial in July 1963. Without getting too off topic, Stephen Ward had been a central figure in a British political scandal which came to be known as the Profumo Affair. It was the name given to a sexual scandal between the Secretary of State for War, John Profumo, and Christine Keeler, a 19-year-old would-be model. The matter became a scandal because Keeler was also in a sexual relationship with the senior naval attaché at the Soviet embassy, leading to an issue of national security. In June 1963, Stephen Ward was charged with immorality offences. He was the one who had originally introduced Profumo to Christine Keeler, and many of their liaisons took place at Ward's home. During his trial, Frances Brown, Christine Keeler, and Mandy Rice Davies testified that Stephen Ward had been living off the immoral earnings of Keeler and Rice Davies. Could this have been a motive for her death? Jack the Stripper's final victim was a 27-year-old Irish woman, Bridget Bridie O'Hara. O'Hara disappeared on the 11th of January 1965. She had been drinking in a Shepherd's Bush hotel before she went off with an unidentified man. Her body was discovered on the 16th of February 1965, 5 weeks after she went missing. Her body was found near a storage shed behind the Heron Trading Estate in Acton. She had been strangled, and there were signs that her body had been stored somewhere warm. Again, her body had flecks of industrial paint, which police were able to trace to an electrical transformer near to where her body had been discovered. It's possible the transformer was also the source of the heat. Bridget O'Hara would be Jack the Stripper's final victim. So, let's take a look at the police investigation. John DeRose took over as the officer in charge of the investigation in February 1965. He told the press that he wanted West London to be flooded with police, and so brought in literally hundreds of officers, including a 200-strong CID force, plus another 100 officers, and a special patrol group of 300 officers. Observation points were set up around a 24-square-mile area of West London to monitor the cars at night. In the spring of 1965, the investigation took a step forward as the police were able to match a paint sample to the paint recovered from the victims' bodies. The paint was found concealed under a transformer at the rear of a building on the Heron factory estate in Acton. The factory was located opposite a paint spraying shop. Through analysis of dust and paint particles, police were able to confirm that the last four women were stored at an abandoned factory on the same Heron trading estate where the body of Bridget O'Hara had been found. Police then began the grueling task of interviewing the 7,000 estate employees. Also as part of the investigation, police women were disguised as prostitutes with tight skirts and low-cut blouses. They were there to keep an eye out for suspicious activity and to note down any car registration plates. Officers tried to reason with the prostitutes, begging them to break their vow of silence, but to no avail. As part of the investigation, John DeRose told reporters that he had been able to narrow the suspect pool down to 10 men and then down to a further three. And yet the killer was never caught, which must have been quite embarrassing. In an open letter to the killer, the London Evening News wrote, quote, "Perhaps you can't help yourself when in the midst of your obscenities with a cheap-bought woman, the red mist comes down and your hands tighten and tighten and tighten." I take a lot of issue with this quote, but I think it speaks to the mentality of people at the time with regards to prostitution. Another newspaper article wrote, quote, "The press clamoured for the capture of the Thameside killer of London's good time girls." Now, before I go off on a tangent about sexism and sex work, we're going to pause here to play a trailer for one of our podcasting friends, Dark Matter Podcast. Please give them a listen, leave them a lovely review, and tell them that I sent you.
Hi, I'm Dominique.
And I'm Avalon.
And we're from Dark Matter Podcast. Dark Matter is a weekly podcast where we talk about a bunch of topics like mysteries, true crime, issues in society, as well as diving deeper into pop culture. In the past, we've done episodes on the Dyatlov Pass mystery, the Bermuda Triangle, and we also have an ongoing Dark Side of series, so make sure to stay tuned.
We release new episodes every Monday on Spotify and Apple Podcasts, or if you prefer to watch, you can hang out with us on YouTube every week. You can follow us on Instagram at Dark Matter Pod and Twitter at Dark Matter _ Pod.
We're now going to look at some of the more prominent suspects in the Jack the Stripper case. Our first suspect is a particularly weird man by the name of Kenneth Archibald, a 57-year-old caretaker at the Holland Park Lawn Tennis Club. Now, the reason I call him weird is that on the 27th of April 1964, Kenneth Archibald walked into Notting Hill Police Station and voluntarily confessed to the murder of Irene Lockwood. He would confess a second time whilst awaiting his court hearing. He was interviewed by police, who later charged him with the murder. His case was then sent to the Old Bailey for trial in June 1964. However, when he appeared before the court and His Honour Judge Neil asked him to enter his plea, he entered a plea of not guilty, effectively retracting his confession. As there was no other evidence to link him to the crime, he was found not guilty by a jury after just 55 minutes of deliberation. He later admitted that he had indeed invented the story because he was lonely and depressed. He said he'd never even met the girl. A psychologist said that Archibald could have made up the fake story in a moment of despair and could have given himself up to, quote, seek a haven of custody for himself while he sorted out his troubles. After the trial, Archibald said, quote, "I know now what a fool I was to confess. It was only after I was finally charged with murder that I realised what I had done. It has been a harrowing ordeal. I will have to look for a job because, as far as I know, I cannot go back to the tennis club. For the moment, I just want to have a drink and take life quietly. Our next suspect is Mungo Ireland. Firstly, doesn't that sound like a made-up name? According to DeRose, Ireland was the most likely suspect. Ireland first appeared on the police radar after the death of the stripper's final victim, Bridget O'Hara. The flecks of paint found on her body were traced back to the Heron Trading Estate, where Ireland worked as a security guard. Unfortunately, shortly after this connection was made, Mungo Ireland committed suicide by carbon monoxide. Before his death, he left a note to his wife which read, "I can't stick it any longer. It may be my fault, but not all of it. I'm sorry Harry is a burden to you. Give my love to the kid. Farewell, Jock. P.S. To save you and the police looking for me, I'll be in the garage." Police had been looking for Ireland because he was due before a court in relation to some minor motoring offence. Recent research, however, has indicated that Ireland could not have been the killer because he was in Scotland at the time that Bridget O'Hara, the stripper's final victim, was killed, and that DeRose had set Ireland up. In an article called "He Framed a Dead Man," it's said that there was actually very little evidence connecting Ireland to the crimes, and that the one connection police did have was tenuous at best, because Ireland had actually only spent 3 weeks as a security guard on the Heron Trading Estate. In 2001, a reformed gangster, Jimmy Tippett Jr., claimed to have uncovered evidence suggesting that Jack the Stripper was in fact the British light heavyweight boxing champion, Freddie Mills. It was said that what Mills lacked in skill, he more than made up for in aggression, being crowned champion in 1948. He was described as a, quote, darling to the media and a hero to millions. Whilst conducting research for his book, Tippett said, "I have spoken to famous figures in the underworld and senior police officers in Scotland Yard, and I am convinced Freddie Mills was the killer. Contrary to his public image, Mills was a sexually warped sadist who enjoyed inflicting pain," end quote. Tippett stated that gangsters such as Charlie Richardson and Frankie Fraser had apparently long suspected Mills of being the murderer. Another person who also suspected Freddie Mills was a freelance journalist, Peter Neal. Neal claimed to have been told by the chief inspector of police that Mills had, quote, killed the nude prostitutes. He said that this was common knowledge in the West End, and that people would say, "Oh, Freddie did them in." However, when the allegations were put to the investigating officer, he stated that Mills had never been a suspect during the investigation. In July 1965, Freddie Mills was found dead in his car, apparently by suicide, although many dispute this. Mills' body was found in the back of his car, down an alleyway in Soho. There was a wound to his head, and a small caliber rifle was found resting between his knees. Some people believed that Mills had committed suicide because he was secretly bisexual and was facing a criminal charge of indecency, or because he couldn't cope with the loss of his close friend, Michael Holliday, with whom he was having an affair. Some suggested his suicide was staged by Chinese gangsters because they wanted his nightclub. Kate Cray told reporters that, according to her husband Ronnie, Mills was not bisexual. She described Mills as, quote, a real man's man, and that he wasn't that way inclined. One author, James Morton, believed that Freddie Mills killed himself because he was about to be killed by the Cray twins. That, coupled with his marriage problems, his depression, and Mills' persistent headaches from too many punches to the head, were enough to push the ex-boxer over the edge. According to Morton, Italian hardman Robert Basils Rossi was the answer. I'm not sure what sort of crime name. I mean, Basils? Doesn't exactly, it's not scary, is it? Anyway, Ronnie Cray had supposedly told Rossi that Mills's business partner was looking to get rid of him and had offered to pay. Rosie, a friend of Mills, approached Freddie, telling him this and advising him to give a little or there would be trouble. Just 5 days later, Freddie was found in his car. Morton wrote, quote, "He had reached the end of his tether. He was no longer the popular figure he once was, and he was in desperate financial trouble because the club was a black hole swallowing money." Many people, however, including his friends, his family, celebrities, and major criminals, believed that Freddie had been murdered. Chrissy, Mills's widow, believed his murder was an example to others who were extorting money from club owners. She alleged that a former professional wrestler had had his West End venue vandalized after he refused to pay money to the gangsters for protection. Tippett found that shortly before Mills's death, he had been asking around about a pistol, with Mills insisting that he needed the weapon himself. When he wasn't able to secure a gun, he went to see his friend, Mary Ronaldson, who ran a rifle range at the Battersea Funfair. Mills told his friend that he needed to borrow the weapon to complete his cowboy fancy dress outfit. Tippett said, quote, "In those days, the members of the boxing fraternity were like a Masonic circle. A lot of people who were close to him, including my father, are still unwilling to talk about exactly what was said during those times, and those who are won't say anything on the record. But I've been told that Freddie feared the police were closing in on him for the murders and decided to take his own life rather than face trial. He had apparently been suffering from dizzy spells and bouts of depression for some time." A fact which supports the murder theory is that Mills was shot in the right eye, which, let's be honest, is a crazy place to shoot yourself. Plus, his eye was open when he died. The medical officer on duty the night Mills's body was brought in believed that someone had taken Mills's gun, shot him with it, but he was never called to give evidence at the inquest. Leonard Nipper Reed, the officer responsible for the investigation into Freddie Mills's death, stated he believed that Mills had committed suicide, but that he didn't think Mills was responsible for the stripper murders. It was said that Mills fit the description of a suspect who was described as a married man and former boxer in his 40s, who committed suicide in the same year as Mills. This person has never been formally named. Another somewhat surprising suspect was a Metropolitan Police officer. Now, his identity has never been released, but it's said that he was a former Met Police detective who was considered a suspect in the opinions of several senior detectives investigating the Jack the Stripper case. He does seem like a bit of an odd duck. For example, he would carry out burglaries to embarrass his colleagues. One of these colleagues called him creepy. When his crimes were discovered, he lost his job, and in 1962 he was jailed for a year. This officer had lived in police quarters near the Heron Trading Estate. It was known that he held a grudge against the police and knew the areas where the bodies were found. However, no evidence could tie him to the crimes. It was said that if a police officer was involved, he would have known all the observation points, the alleyways, the abandoned factories. As a police officer, his job would have afforded him the opportunity to stalk his victims whilst he was on duty. And he'd be one step ahead, basically. He'd know when to stop if the manhunt was getting close. Now, there isn't much information about our next suspect, Superintendent Tommy Butler, other than he was a member of the Met Police's flying squad. Nevertheless, Jimmy Evans and Martin Short, in their 2002 book, The Survivor, named Butler as a suspect. Butler died in 1970. Other suspects have included a dental surgeon, a mortuary assistant, and the victim's partners. In my opinion, our next suspect is definitely the most compelling, a man by the name of Harold Jones. Harold Jones had a very sinister past. In 1921, when he was just 15 years old, Jones was accused of murdering 8-year-old Frida Burnell, but was acquitted because of a lack of evidence. 2 weeks later, he murdered 11-year-old Florence Little. In court, he pleaded guilty to Little's murder and confessed to the murder of Frida Burnell. Jones claimed to have committed the murders by bludgeoning and strangulation because of a desire to kill. He escaped the death penalty because he was under 16 at the time the crimes were committed and was instead given a life sentence. He was imprisoned on the 1st of November 1921. It's said that Jones was released after 20 years for what was described as exemplary behaviour, although another source suggests that both the governor of the prison and the prison psychiatrist were both against his release. So, after being released on parole from HMP Wandsworth in 1941, it's suggested that a 35-year-old Harold Jones went back to the town where he committed his hideous crimes and actually visited the graves of his victims. He then left the area and disappeared. Yeah, so we are dealing with a pretty nasty character. By 1947, Harold Jones had moved to Fulham in London. People drew comparisons between Jones's original two murders and the stripper murders in that there was no sexual assault, but there was extreme violence against the victims. The author of the book Every Mother's Nightmare, Neil Milkins, believed that Harold Jones was indeed Jack the Stripper. When tracing Jones's movements, Milkins found that the pattern correlated with that of the stripper killings in such a way that it couldn't be considered a coincidence. Quote, he turned up in Fulham in the late 1940s, calling himself Harry Stevens, and stayed at the address in Hestercombe Avenue until 1962, at which point he disappeared again. I came across the Jack the Stripper case on the internet and realised that in the same 3 years Jones's whereabouts remained unknown, 1962 to 1965, a number of prostitutes had been murdered in the same West London area. End quote. Having had a family of his own, Harold Jones died of bone cancer in Hammersmith in 1971 at the age of 64. Milkins believes that Harold Jones now rests in an unmarked grave in Hammersmith New Cemetery in West London. Milkins believes that the stripper case should be reinvestigated as there were just too many coincidences for Jones not to be connected. For example, Jones at one time worked as a sheet metal worker. As part of his job, he would have had to use industrial paint spray, the same sort of spray found on the victims' bodies. Also, in 1959, 5 years before Hannah's murder, Harold Jones, or Harry Stevens, had lived only two streets away from her. He then later moved to Hammersmith under another name. In these digs, he was just two streets away from both the seventh and eighth victims, Frances Brown and Bridget O'Hara. Another comparison Milkins noted was that at least four of the stripper's victims had been stored for a period of time. There was evidence in Jones's original murder cases that the bodies of the two girls had been stored, awaiting disposal. Harold Jones also took trophies from his Welsh victims in the form of their handkerchiefs. In the Jack the Stripper case, it was said that the killer took trophies in the form of his victims' teeth after their death. An interesting aspect of this case is that none of the victims were sexually assaulted, despite the fact that the victims' work was sexual in nature. It was suggested by a prison medical officer that Harold Jones received sexual gratification from the acts of cruelty and killing and was therefore not interested in the sexual acts themselves. In addition to the increasing list of connections, Milkins identified that the last victim, Bridget O'Hara, went missing on the 11th of January 1965, which would have been Harold Jones's 58th birthday. Milkins said, quote, it sends a chill up my spine to think she could have been his one last birthday present to himself. Jones was an evil psychopath. He destroyed lives back in 1921, and having spoken to children of his later murder victims, he's affecting people right to this very day. A professor of criminology, David Wilson, gave credence to the findings of Neil Milkins, saying, quote, he has shed new light on the Hammersmith murders. I think he may have hit on something here. We know that a serial killer, Harold Jones, was living in the streets around the Jack the Stripper murders, and, in my experience, there is no such thing as coincidence when dealing with serial killers. So for me, there is quite compelling evidence. Another pathologist and professor, Bernard Knight CBE, said, quote, "The geographical coincidences he has unearthed relating to the movements of Harold Jones are startling." In an article from February 2019, it was said that police were considering whether to reopen the case of Jack the Stripper. However, it seems as though they haven't confirmed whether they will be reopening the case or not. When talking about this case, David Wilson said the following, and I think it's a nice point to end on. Quote, "Because the victims were seen as sex workers, they were seen as less deserving. Their lives didn't matter. It is really important that we try and get justice for the families of these women, even if their crimes were committed in the 1960s. And in Harold Jones, we are giving to the police evidence that they never had at the time, and he emerges as a prime suspect." And that's the end of today's episode. I guess we'll just have to see whether the police decide to move forward with this case. I'll be sure to let you know if they do. Thank you so much for joining me for today's episode. The Student's Verdict is a bi-weekly podcast, so please follow us on social media to hear about our next episode. The Student's Verdict can be found on Apple Podcasts, YouTube, Spotify, Stitcher, Podbean, Buzzsprout, Spreaker, Google Play, and now iHeartRadio. While you're there, why not check out Dark Matter Podcast? Next week, I have a very special guest to celebrate our 10th episode. You aren't going to want to miss it. See you on the next one, and remember to keep living the dream.